Chapter 22. Scattered chunks of ice dotted the rolling waters of Lancaster Strait, appearing in the dusk like jagged marshmallows floating in a sea of hot chocolate. Against the dim background of Devon Island, a black behemoth crept along the horizon, billowing a trail of dark smoke.
Range 12 kilometers, sir. She's beating a path right across our bow.
The helmsman, a red-haired ensign with jug ears, peered from a radar scope to the ship's captain and waited for a response. Captain Dick Weber lowered a pair of binoculars without taking his gaze off the distant vessel.
"Keep us on intersect, at least until we obtain an identification," he replied without turning.
The helmsman twisted the ship's wheel a half-turn, then resumed studying the radar screen. The 80-foot Canadian Coast Guard patrol vessel plowed slowly through the dark Arctic waters toward the path of the oncoming vessel. Assigned to interdiction duty along the eastern approaches to the Northwest Passage, the Harp had been on station just a few days. Though the winter ice had continued the trend of breaking up early, this was the first commercial vessel the patrol craft had seen in the frosty waters this season. In another month or two, there would be a steady stream of massive tankers and container ships making the northerly transit, accompanied by icebreakers. Just a few years prior, the thought of policing traffic through the Northwest Passage would have been laughable. Since man's earliest forays into the Arctic, major sections of the annual winter pack ice remained frozen solid for all but a few summer days. Only a few hardy explorers and the occasional icebreaker dared fight their way through the blocked passage. But global warming had changed everything, and now the passage was navigable for months out of the year. Scientists estimate that over 40,000 square miles of Arctic ice have receded in just the past 30 years. Much of the blame for the rapid melt-off is due to the ice albedo feedback effect. In its frozen state, Arctic ice will reflect up to 90% of incoming solar radiation. When melted, the resulting seawater will conversely absorb an equal amount of radiation, reflecting only about 10%. This warming loop has accounted for the fact that Arctic temperatures are climbing at double the global rate. Watching the bow of his patrol boat slice through a small ice floe, Weber silently cursed what global climate change had done to him. Transferred from Quebec and comfortable sea duty along the St. Lawrence River, he now found himself in command of a ship at one of the most remote locations on the planet. And his job, he thought, had been relegated to little more than that of a toll booth operator. Weber could hardly blame his superiors, though, for they were just following the mandate of Canada's saber-rattling Prime Minister. When historically frozen sections of the Northwest Passage began to melt clear, the Prime Minister was quick to act, affirming the passage as Canadian internal waters and authorizing funds for a deep-water Arctic port at Nanisivik. Promises to build a fleet of military icebreakers and establish new Arctic bases soon followed. Powerful lobbying by a shadowy interest group propelled the Parliament to support the Prime Minister by passing tough restrictions on foreign vessels transiting the passage. By law, all non-Canadian-flagged ships seeking transit through the passage were now required to notify the Coast Guard of their planned route, pay a passage fee similar to that imposed at the Panama Canal, and be accompanied by a Canadian commercial icebreaker through the more restrictive areas of the passage. A few countries, Russia, Denmark, and the United States among them, refuted Canada's claim and discouraged travel through the waters. But other developed nations gladly complied in the name of economics. Merchant ships serving Europe with East Asia could trim thousands of miles off their shipping routes by bypassing the Panama Canal. The savings were even more dramatic for ships too large to pass through the canal that would otherwise have to sail around Cape Horn. With the potential to cut the shipping cost of a single storage container by $1,000, merchant fleets, large and small, were quick to eye the Arctic crossing as a lucrative commercial path. As the ice melt-off expanded more rapidly than scientists anticipated, the first few shipping companies had begun testing the frigid waters. Thick sheets of ice still clogged sections of the route for much of the year, but during the heat of summer, the passage had regularly become ice-free. With the aid of powerful icebreakers, the more ambitious merchant fleets were hoping to run the passage from April through September. It was becoming all too evident that within a decade or two, The Northwest Passage would be a navigable waterway year-round. Staring at the approaching black merchant ship, Weber wished the whole passage would just freeze solid again. At least the presence of the ship broke up the monotony of staring at icebergs, he thought dryly. 4 kilometers in closing, the helmsman reported. Weber turned to a lanky radio man wedged into a corner of the small bridge. Hopkins, request an identification in the nature of her cargo, he barked. The radio man proceeded to call the ship, but all his queries were met with silence. He checked the radio, then transmitted several more times. She's not responding, sir, he finally replied with a perplexed look. His experience with passing vessels in the Arctic was that they were usually prone to excessive chit-chat by the isolated crews. Keep trying, Weber ordered. We're nearly close enough for a visual ID. 2 kilometers off, the helmsman confirmed. Weber retrained his binoculars and examined the vessel. She was a relatively small container ship of no more than 400 feet. She was, by appearance, a newer vessel, but oddly showed only a few containers on her topside deck. Similar ships, he knew, often carried containers stacked 6 or 7 layers high. Curious, he studied her plimsoll line, noting the mark was several feet above the water. Moving his gaze vertically, he looked at a darkened bridge, then at a masthead behind the superstructure. He was startled to see the stars and stripes fluttering in the stiff breeze. She's American, he muttered. The nationality surprised him, as American ships had informally boycotted the passage at the urging of their government. Weber focused the glasses on the ship's bow, just making out the name Atlanta in white lettering as the evening light began to fade. Her name is the Atlanta, he said to Hopkins. The radio operator nodded and tried hailing the ship by name, but there was still no response. Weber hung the binoculars on a metal hook, then located a binder on the chart table and flipped it open, searching for the name Atlanta on a computer printout. All non-Canadian vessels making a transit of the Northwest Passage were required to file notification with the Coast Guard 96 hours in advance. Weber checked to see that his file had been updated by satellite link earlier in the day, but still found no reference for the Atlanta. Bring us up on her port bow. Hopkins, tell them that they are crossing Canadian territorial waters and order her to stop for boarding and inspection. While Hopkins transmitted the message, the helmsman adjusted the ship's heading, then glanced at the radar screen. The channel narrows ahead, sir, he reported. Pack ice encroaching on our port beam approximately 3 kilometers ahead. Weber nodded, his eyes still glued to the Atlanta. The merchant ship was moving at a surprisingly fast clip, over 15 knots, he guessed. As the Coast Guard vessel edged closer, Weber again observed that the ship was riding high on the water. Why would a lightly laden ship be attempting the passage, he wondered. 1 kilometer to intercept, the helmsman said. Come right. Bring us to within 100 meters, the captain ordered. The black merchant ship was oblivious to the Coast Guard patrol craft, or so it seemed to the Canadians. Had they tracked the radar set more closely, they would have noticed that the American ship was both accelerating and subtly changing course. Why won't they respond? Muttered the helmsman, growing weary of Hopkins's unanswered radio calls. We'll get their attention now, Weber said. The captain walked to the console and pressed a button that activated the ship's marine air horn. 2 long blasts bellowed from the horn, the deep bray echoing across the water. The blare drew the men on the bridge to silence as they awaited a response. Again, there was none. There was little more Weber could do. Unlike in the United States, the Canadian Coast Guard was operated as a civilian organization. The Harp's crew was not military trained, and the vessel carried no armament. The helmsman eyed the radar screen and reported no reduction in speed. In fact, I think she's still accelerating. Sir, we're coming along the ice pack. Weber detected a sudden urgency in his voice. While focused on the merchant ship, the helmsman had neglected to track the hardened pack ice that now flanked their port side. To starboard, the steaming merchant ship rode just a dozen meters away and had drawn nearly even with the patrol craft. Weber looked up at the high bridge of the Atlanta and wondered what kind of fool was in command of the ship. Then he noticed the bow of the freighter suddenly veer toward his own vessel, and he quickly realized this was no game. "Hard left rudder!" he screamed. The last thing anyone expected was for the merchant ship to turn into them, but in an instant the larger vessel was right on top of the Harp. Like a bug under the raised foot of an elephant, the patrol boat madly scrambled to escape a crushing blow. Frantically reacting to Weber's command, the helmsman jammed the wheel full over and prayed they would slip by the bigger ship. But the Atlanta was too close. The side hull of the freighter slammed into the Harp with a deep thud. The point of impact came to the boat's stern, however, as the smaller vessel had nearly turned away. The blow knocked the Harp hard over, nearly capsizing her as a large wave rolled over the deck. In what felt like an eternity to the stricken crew, the Coast Guard craft gradually rolled back upright as it fell away from the bristling sides of the merchant ship. Their peril was not over, however. Unknown to the crew, the collision had torn off the vessel's rudder. With its propeller still spinning madly, the patrol boat surged straight into the nearby ice pack. The Harp drove several feet into the thick ice before grounding to a sudden halt, flinging the ship's crew forward. On the bridge, Weber picked himself up off the deck and helped shut down the vessel's engine, then quickly assessed the health of his ship and crew. An assortment of cuts and bruises was the worst of the personal injuries, but the patrol boat fared less well. In addition to the lost rudder, the ship's crumpled bow had compromised the outer hull. The Harp would remain embedded in the ice for 4 days before a tow would arrive to take the ship to port for repairs. Wiping away a trickle of blood from a gash to his cheek, Weber stepped to the bridge wing and peered to the west. He saw the running lights of the merchant ship for just a second before the big ship disappeared into a gloomy, dark fog bank that stretched across the horizon. Watching as the ship disappeared, Weber shook his head. "You brazen bastard," he muttered. "You'll pay for this." Weber's words would prove to ring hollow. A fast-moving storm front south of Baffin Island grounded the Canadian Air Command CP-140 Aurora reconnaissance plane called in by the Coast Guard. When the aircraft finally lifted off from its base in Greenwood, Nova Scotia, and arrived over Lancaster Strait, more than 6 hours had elapsed. Farther west, a Navy icebreaker and another Coast Guard cutter blocked the passage off Prince of Wales Island, waiting for the belligerent freighter to arrive. But the large black ship never appeared. The Canadian Coast Guard and Air Force scoured the navigable seas around Lancaster Strait for 3 days in search of the rogue vessel. Every available route west was scrutinized several times over, yet the American merchant ship was nowhere to be seen. Baffled, the Canadian forces quietly called off the search, leaving Weber and his crew to wonder how the strange ship had somehow disappeared into the Arctic ice.